On today's program, my special guest is Dr. Mary Grace Pinello. We're going to be talking about finding joy and contentment. And I'll play an encore presentation of one of my first interviews with the great Daphne Kingma about her book, Loving Yourself. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversations begin now. Mary Grace, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Usually you're in here cutting spots, and now you're here for an actual interview, which you haven't done for quite a while.
I know.
A topic. Actually, I just listened to this topic the night before. Andrew Harvey is teaching a lot on joy. His last book was on Finding Joy. I just now ordered it from Amazon. And he was on Shift Network for about an hour, giving a typical deep and profound and inspirational talk on joy and why we need it now more than ever.
Well, so. And I need to go back and catch that because I did not hear it, and I'm sure I would love to. But, you know, it's just been a thing lately that I realize that I have found some joy and I'm claiming some contentment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tell my patients all the time, you know, meditation is a really important part of your healing because everything that happens to us happens in the brain. And so when you meditate, you calm your brain. And so I think it's important to also claim your joy and claim your contentment because in the crazy life that 2018 is, there's way too many people trying to claim your unhappiness, trying to get you incited to riot, you know, trying to just see how many buttons they can push for you.
Yes.
And you know, in life, in anywhere, you find what you look for. So if you look for joy, you're going to find some. If you look for contentment, it might be harder to find, but it's there. And, you know, even if we claim just 2 minutes at a time of it, it's such a release for the body. It's such a release for all of the stressors that build up over time on our system that, you know, these days we can't afford not to claim it. You know, it's nice to live in it, but you really can't afford physically not to claim some contentment and joy.
How much of it, though, is that we've always had it? Most babies have it.
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot of teachers these days, thank God, because of the glut of spiritual and personal development, said it's really about remembrance. It's about calming the heart, calming the mind, and reclaiming that natural state that we probably had all this time.
Absolutely. We are born with it. You look at any baby and you realize they're in complete joy. Yes, I think that's a great part of it. And I think the people at HeartMath have a real lock on that, on how to get that done and how to teach people to go back and claim it. I don't claim to be a guru of any sort. This is a truth I have found lately and I have been sharing with as many people as I absolutely can because I think it's really a conscious choice every day and we forget that it's a choice. You know, we think, oh, wait, let me just be blissed out. Will that work with some alcohol or some drugs or what have you? And it's a choice to be blissed out. So
now twice you've mentioned lately. You've learned this in a deeper way, so I have to ask what happened lately to cause maybe a deeper knowing of what you're talking about.
You know, it's funny. My parents were pretty forward-thinking and let me go to a Silva class when I was 14. And so I learned how to meditate very early in life. But there were great, big, huge portions of my life where I forgot I had the skill. But lately, I have been reclaiming it. I'm very grateful to the Chopra Center because every quarter they do their 28-day meditation experience. And as of the last quarter of 2017, I do it every quarter. But, you know, it's a nice habit for 28 days, and I let it get away from me. Well, starting at the end of that experience in 2017, and since then, I have meditated every day. And it may only be a 15-minute meditation. It may have been a half an hour meditation. But it really does change your perspective. It's changed my perspective for sure. You know, in moments of extreme pain, I was having some cupping work done. And for those of you who know what cupping is, that's a understandable experience. But, you know, when wet cups are applied to you and it's like, you know, big suction cups on your body, it can be very painful. And, you know, and he was so cute about it. He said, okay, see you in 7 minutes. And my eyes got as big as quarters. And I'm like, 7 minutes? And instantly I started breathing. And I was able to endure it without it being an endurance, with it just being, oh, I'm just breathing through this. It's good. And I think from there, it actually, you know, I kind of tripped over contentment. It was a nice tripping stone. But when I realized it, I'm like, oh, I know what this is. I kind of like this. Can I stay here for a little bit? And sure enough, it's a choice all the time.
Yeah, anytime there's a pattern interrupt. So it could happen through meditation. I know Tony Robbins has made a whole career basically teaching neurolinguistic programming, which wasn't his idea, but he called it NAC, and then later finally gave credit to Grinder and Blander, who founded that. But same thing is a pattern interrupt. I know a lot of people in death awareness, Nita Morjani, I was re-listening to that interview, and when all the tumors fell off her body because she crossed over and then came back and experienced, not just learned, but experienced that unconditional love and bliss, her big thing now, and I've heard this by a couple of other TED Talk teachers, TEDx Talk teachers who have had similar experiences about being close to death, their question now is, matter of fact, one of them even says, what is joy asking you?
I love that
so
question.
So it's really befriending joy. It's making joy your friend, your constant companion, talking to joy. And then because she realized when she finally survived this tumor that was wrapping around her vocal cords and her brainstem, they were able to take it out, but now her head is kind of fused into her spine, and she kind of joked about this. Powerful TED Talk from Boulder, TEDx. But she said it made her reevaluate everything because she was an achiever. She was a marathon runner, a high-class marathon runner, always on the go, always on the go. And now she's learned to see the beauty in the ordinary, to slow down. Now she's a coach helping people to slow down. And she was going to yet another Super Bowl party with her husband and finally said, why am I going to these parties? I hate football. So she said she finally had to share that with her friend, and her friend knew that she loved her. But that's when she said, it didn't bring me joy. And I've realized I should have died, and I didn't. And I only want, and this is what Anita Morjani said, I only want to commit to those things that bring me joy. So I guess that's another way
Absolutely.
To help you kind of rewire your brain, basically.
Absolutely. You know, and coaches, life coaches will tell you it's all about state management. Mm-hmm. So when you've experienced it, it's much easier to find it and get back to it. So yeah. The practice of state management is once you know what that feels like, then you find an anchor, whether that's, you know, three fingers together or whether that's you snapping your fingers, whatever you need for an anchor so that you can access that state at any time.
Yes.
So in moments of extreme stress, boom, you can go to that place of contentment, mm-hmm. you know, and the phrase fake it till you make it mm-hmm. really fits right there because mm-hmm. nobody can conceive of being at that high stress level and then all of a sudden being totally content.
Yeah.
But if you can let that physiology cue happen, then you certainly can feel the benefits of being in contentment or being in joy.
Yeah, because what you just talked about is neurolinguistic programming. I think it's a hoot. The older I get, you look back on everything and say, God, everything's about the same.
Exactly.
We just put a little twist on it here. This author writes it in his style. But, you know, Eckhart Tolle stuff was founded by Buddhism way before him. So the thing is, the material is out there. The knowledge is out there. But it does take some kind of emotional state, which is why I think meditation is powerful.
Right.
I don't want everybody to have a death awareness experience, but that is powerful if you've had something like that. The point is, it's being more conscious of how you want to live. And I wish I could remember a lot of the stuff that Andrew said. I just listened to it last night. But because of the darkness we're living in, because of the constant bombardment of bad news, he's of the belief now that the greatest power right now is not love, it's joy. And because with having that joy, and the two or three people he mentioned as models of that was not only His Holiness the Dalai Lama, but Jane Goodall,
mm-hmm.
And what she has done, and also seeing the atrocities with the abuse of animals. And so, I think it's something we absolutely need to be revisiting. And I think it was, a couple of years ago that His Holiness and Tutu had a book on joy, too.
Yep. And I was, when I was preparing for this, I was accessing some of Matthieu Ricard's work, too, because mm-hmm. he's also about the joy.
Yeah.
And you're right. For me, the access route is meditation. You know, I'm thankful I've never had a near-death experience, but for meditation, for me, meditation, you know, it helps me claim my time.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to be silent. It's time to be in nature, time to restore my energy. I love grounding. The concept of grounding is just amazing. The earth has everything we need in terms mm-hmm. of electrons to calm the overly oxidative reactions that are happening in your system, to be real technical. But it just feels good to have your feet in the grass. And, you know, here in Indiana, we don't get to do that a whole lot of the time of the year. So when it's time, do it. Get out there. Put your feet in the grass. I don't recommend it if you know the grass has been treated with chemicals, but, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. move beyond that if mm-hmm. you have to. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, and we've seen so much of this, is living in gratitude, finding a way to be thankful even when we're miserable, mm-hmm. Even when there's pain, even when there's suffering. What's this bringing me? There's a gift here I know there is. You know, the come from is there's a gift here I know there is. Let me find it. Let mm-hmm. me see it. Let me appreciate it. Not to take it away, not to make it so that we're not in pain anymore, but so that the pain has a meaning, a deeper meaning, and, mm-hmm. and it's connected to joy. I'm sure they're connected through underground tunnels that you just kind of have to find the access route to.
Yeah, when you speak of pain, that also speaks of the shadow, and that was a third part of Andrew's presentation and a third part of his book, which I'm looking forward to reading, is we don't want to just mask it with everything. We also need to go deep and allow that pain to come up in order for it to heal. So he said we need that balance of all of that, and we can only probably truly experience joy when we finally have experienced that pain and had that wail, you know, instead of a little boo-hoo, tee-hee cry, or whatever that is that you need to do. And yeah. So many people these days, I think, especially in European Western society, I'll label it that way, we're pent up, man. We button it up. We don't like to show those emotions.
Mm-hmm. I read a book one time, and I cannot recall the author's name, but it was The Dark Night of the Soul. And it was a Christian author who was talking about, you know, just what we're talking about now, embracing that pain, embracing that darkness so that you can truly understand it and not be controlled by it, mm-hmm. not be a victim, but to be the victor, as mm-hmm. it were, and to get through and to see. Because there's always benefits. There's always right. something more. You know, when you expand and you have a greater capacity to see and or be empathetic for someone else's pain. Mm-hmm. And that's never a bad thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a little empathy would go a really long way these days.
Yeah.
But more important, empathy for yourself, mm-hmm. and not being so, like you said, buttoned up and afraid to face what's you know, yeah, it's scary. Mm-hmm. I'll go there. It's definitely scary. But having the courage to face it and appreciating that there can be joy on the other side of it,
yeah.
that, you know, that it's an access route. And sometimes it's through the ugliness to get to the joy.
You mentioned the Christian writer. I don't know who that was, but the original Christian writer who wrote on Dark Night of Soul, St. John of the Cross, who died in the 1500s. He was a friend of St. Teresa of Avila. He was also a renegade priest. The other priests jailed him, as they often did. Get cynical about
my
organized
kind of
churches. And but in reading about his life, the prisons they had back then made the prisons today look like the Hiltons. And yet, while he was in there, he would write the most beloved literature because he was a Christian mystic in the same vein as Rumi. And that was just amazing. And that was the other part that Andrew talked about in there. The other thing that helps in cultivating that joy and keeping that joy in dark times is having that love for the divine, whatever that means for you.
Mm-hmm.
For Jane Goodall, it was probably nature and animals. I don't know if she had a specific religion. I don't think she did. But sustaining that as well. And so I guess when we think about it, we could probably just jot down on a piece of paper some 3 or 4 or 5 simple things we've talked about if we were just mindful of it a little bit every day.
Right. I remember a homily from a long time ago about a prisoner and a prisoner of war who was in the concentration camp. And he had a note in his pocket, and he kept that note with him at all times. And it was... he was praying for his captors. I don't know what kind of soul it takes to be able to do that, but it was said that he was the most joyful of prisoners. You know, everyone that knew him in the barracks, you know, knew him to be a person of joy. And I assume it's that ability to look beyond self and to, you know, to care for others,
yeah.
but
yeah.
that amazing ability to forgive has got to go a long, long way in helping you be joyful.
That's a great question. Why are some people seemingly already wired that way, such as Viktor Frankl, who
mm-hmm.
was in the concentration camp, and out of
right.
that came In Search of Meaning?
Yep.
I remember I get the Daily Good every day, and they were talking about a contemporary of Anne Frank, but somebody who I'd never heard about because she never really got the fame or notoriety. She died but she spent her years as a teenager in the concentration camp, 2 or 3 years, choosing to bring joy to everybody. And so, and the reason I remember that is because I loved what they described her, at least now, I probably not back then, but they called her Celebrant of Life.
Oh, lovely.
And I thought, we need more celebrants of life. A lot of my friends are celebrants. They officiate weddings, funerals, but a celebrant of life.
Mm.
And how can somebody like that, in a situation I can't even relate to, still then try to bring more joy in people's lives while they know every day family and friends are marching out to the gas chambers?
Yeah,
that's just amazing.
It's, you're right. It has to have been a hardwiring conversation because I you know, as far as I know, there was only one Christ that walked the earth. But, you know, I mean, that's Christ-like behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That's just so much bigger than I think I'm capable of, than mm-hmm. I think most people are capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you see, you know, the there's always a couple of memes on Facebook. That little boy who's taken his allowance and he goes and he buys flowers and he takes flowers to people in the nursing homes.
Yeah.
Just a delightful and little peanut, you know, like 7 years old. We're not.
I wish I could call it up real quick, and I won't be able to, but I read an article that a friend posted on Dr. Matthew Fox, who's been on this show numerous times. He wrote an amazing piece about the archetypal meaning of what happened with those children in Thailand getting saved from the cave, illustrating as the cave was the womb of the divine feminine, the gentle, beautiful expression of divine masculine was going in, but also how humanity came together for something like that, which often people will do when it comes to disasters, but we forget about it when we're back to, quote, ordinary life, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, was there any, I mean, in my lifetime, the only thing I've seen that big was the way the country came together after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we actually cared about one another, and mm-hmm. it was demonstrable. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't just an idea. It wasn't just, you know, six people had this idea and ran with it.
Right.
It was people really genuinely concerned about their neighbors.
Yes. Yes.
And it didn't last long, unfortunately. But we are capable of it. And that's what's so gratifying.
There was an article that I read today from the Daily Good. And those of you who are listening, I believe it's dailygood.com. I encourage you to subscribe to their daily emails. It's all about stories, positive, inspiring stories. Doesn't take long to read. And the one that came in today was called One Square Inch of Silence. And it's about a guy who's done research, and a documentary was made by that. He did it all across the country, and he was trying to discern how much silence is there in America, and especially even in our forests. And without taking too much time on the radio and trying to pull it up, what he found was there's not much at all. As a matter of fact, in the video that you'll see, it's a 4-minute video. He is in the middle of Mount Olympia, I believe it is, in the state of Washington. And he found like 1 square inch in that entire park. Now, he's talking about where there's no planes flying over, where there's no any kind of noise from human beings at all, but just nature.
Wow.
He says in the 48 states, what did he say? 98% of the entire country has noise.
Wow.
And there's only 2 other spots that he found in the state of Washington, but he won't tell you where it is because he's that concerned. More and more people will go there.
Right. And there goes the silence.
And there goes the silence. And he says part of that is because we are branching out so much and so far everywhere we live, and we're pushing the animals out.
Yeah.
We're building our subdivisions in, and we're creating that. And I couldn't help but think, not having had much time to process that, I just saw it this morning, by not having enough silence, I mean, pure silence, that probably even can affect our contentment.
Absolutely.
Our joy.
And our physiology.
Physiology.
Well, and it goes the same conversation about darkness. And I don't mean emotional darkness. I mean literal physical darkness. You know, there's a dark sky initiative in some states that say, you know, street lights can't stay on after a certain time, or they have to be a certain height off the ground, and it's pretty low so that it doesn't impact what you can see in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. You know, we have an awful lot of people who are sleep disturbed. I don't want to say sleep deprived, but sleep disturbed. Their sleep is not good. You know, just if you look what's inside your bedroom, the amount of light that's inside your bedroom when you turn all your lights off is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Between the cell phone that we now use as an alarm clock or a wake-up call, the clock that is now worthless, but it's a clock and you still have it.
Right.
You know, if there's any computer work that's in there, there's that blue light coming out of that. It's and then if you've got windows, there's light coming in from the outside.
Right.
So, you know, when I was in chiropractic school, we had a physiology instructor who was nuts about darkness. This is a man who every night would turn around the microwave, turn around the VCR, turn around everything that had light so that there was complete darkness in his home. His curtains were all blackout curtains. And, you know, his claim was that the pineal gland needs that much time in darkness in order for it to restore us.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't wrong. He was just a little fanatical about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing to me that, you know, I love looking at the sky. I love looking at the sky in the daytime or the nighttime. In the nighttime, we just don't get to see as many stars as are
right.
out there.
Right.
So I love it when I get to spend time in, you know, in places like way out west or,
right.
you know, when I go up to Oshkosh for my air show and at night on the lake. You can see stars because there's not a lot of light, but
mm-hmm.
but light pollution is tragic, and it's also detrimental to our peace of mind, to
mm-hmm.
our body's peace.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. So as a chiropractor, what mm-hmm. are some practical tips you might have when people think about the work that you do? I know people have experienced an easement of pain, all kinds of things like that that we've talked about that oftentimes your pre-recorded spots talk about. But now we're talking about just pure contentment. Or as a matter of fact, it reminds me of something Wayne Dyer said once. He said he felt like contentment was perhaps the most powerful thing, because I think about it. If you're truly content, you have no need for anything.
Yeah.
Not even love or joy, or because you're already purely blissed out, content.
Right. Packing it all inside. And it's an
right.
inside job, you know, and that is truly a chiropractic perspective. It's an inside job. The chiropractic motto is from above down and inside out. That's how we heal physiologically. That's how everything happens. So the farther away from your heart that a wound might be, mm-hmm. will take a little longer to heal as opposed to one that's up close to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about the impact of stress on your body, it's huge. And stress will kill you, bottom
mm-hmm.
line.
Mm-hmm.
Most people these days are so inured with stress that they don't even realize they are stressed. So that's a problem for sure. But then when we, you know,
let's just sit with that for a moment.
Sure.
And I agree with you. It's because all they know is stress. Most of the people they probably work with are stressed. The company can be stressful. So that's why they don't know.
Exactly. It's become such a part of our daily living that we don't recognize it as stress. And it's very interesting. Our bodies are built physiologically as though we lived 10,000 years ago and saber-toothed tigers were our biggest stressor. So when we're faced with stress, physiologically, what happens is we pull blood from the center, from the core, from our organs into our arms and legs. The reason for that is so we can run or fight. We also dilate our pupils so that we can see better and can get out of the way. We, instead of deep belly breathing, we shallow breathe so that we can pump more oxygen to those muscles so that they can fight or run. And so all of those things happen, and we are built for that to happen, because think about it in the terms of a saber-toothed tiger chasing you. The tiger's chasing you, and one of two things happens. Either you get away, and that's a beautiful thing, and you fall down and rest, and so does the tiger, or he eats you, and then we're done anyway. But when you fall down and rest, that's when your body restores itself. That's resting and digesting. That's when the blood goes back to the central organs and lets you digest food, lets you process and rebuild yourself and mm-hmm. rebuild your blood cells. And all kinds of important work is done by having blood in the center. We're built for small bursts of stress and large times spent in this resting and digesting phase. So now, you know, advance us to 2018, and can you name your saber-toothed tiger?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, sometimes it has our family's names on it, our work name, the car we're driving or the traffic we're in. Stress never lets up. So there's never that period of a, complete release so that you can go back to spending time and resting and digesting. Mm-hmm. As a consequence of that, we have more people with stomach disorders than we've ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And when those stomach disorders have hung out long enough, it leads to leaky gut, which all goes into the whole autoimmune thing. There are more autoimmune diseases now than there ever have been. They've been identified because we are in such poor health because we're under stress so much. Mm-hmm. And so, and then you add to that the fact that our food is no longer as good as it used to be. And there's even, you know, I mean, I love organic food, but there's even some argument that even organic food isn't as healthy as it used to be because all food used to be organic because we didn't have pesticides. Mm-hmm. But bottom line is we're not being nourished. We're then stressing ourselves to a point of exhaustion. And we never have that snapback time. So bring that to a chiropractic table, and the conversation is every time we adjust you, we help your body resolve some stress, even for just a short period of time. And as you can resolve some of that stress, you can hang out in that parasympathetic or that resting and digesting phase. And so that's a huge benefit for optimizing your function. Yep, you're absolutely right. We're great at pain relief, and everybody knows it.
It almost seems like there needs to be a consortium of healers in one office where and working together, where you have the therapist, you have the chiropractor, you have because the whole self, the whole body. Because now I'm thinking of something Anita has. Well, this is all she teaches on now. Even though she had this dramatic testimony, she just teaches on self-love.
Yeah,
because she said, I ate all the right foods. I had organic. I was so fixated on it, though. I was so serious about it. Doing all those right things, I still came down with cancer. And now what she's learned is by just surrendering. So there's that balance, I guess, in everything.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so for the people out there, I'm wondering, and I feel for them, it's like, well, where do you start? You know, if you're having symptoms of any kind, where do you start? Where do you go? Who do you listen to? There's so much noise out there. And not all the noise is bad. I'm talking about
exactly.
Just
there's
teachings
just
and
lots
CDs
of...
and I have the answer and come here and go there.
It is hard to know. It absolutely is. And you have to develop a team that works for you. You know, and my whole thing is when you enter into the medical system, you need an advocate. You just need somebody who's somebody whose ear is paying attention because you're so wrapped up in you. Mm-hmm. But that's why also we try, you know, in my office, we don't have all of those practitioners under one roof, but I have access to a lot of them. And that's what we do. We make recommendations. We make referrals for sure. Mm-hmm. We have massage therapy in my office because that can help physically pull some stress off your body. We're helping neurologically pull some stress off your body. Then we have contacts with therapists and they're helping you mentally pull some stress off your body. But we're also having a conversation about what are you eating?
Yeah.
You know, and not to the point of let's make you crazy about making sure everything you eat is organic, but literally what are you eating? Because if you're not conscious of what you're eating, then the reality is you're probably putting some stuff in there that's not working for you. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, what are you drinking? How much water in a day do you get in? Mm-hmm. It's really important. But all of this can look like an Iger sanction in front of you, a huge mountain that you can't climb.
Yeah.
And so in our office, we take baby steps, and we encourage everybody to take baby steps. Yes, we want you to do some exercise, but I don't want to make a gym rat out of you next week. That's not going to be helpful. If all we do is start with you walking from here to the car and move the car two parking spaces farther away, I think that's a win.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about meditating. No, I don't want you to go and sit under a tree in lotus position and have mudras and go om. Not necessary. Mm-hmm. You can do a 5-minute breath control meditation. Mm-hmm. That's good. You know, mm-hmm. We have lots of resources. One of my favorite current meditation resources is the app for your phone called Insight Timer. Mm-hmm. It's free and it has a myriad of different insightful teachers
right.
who are doing meditation, and it's all free.
Right.
And there's like 10 new ones to choose from every day. Mm-hmm. If you like one a lot, you can bookmark it and play it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ones that I'm listening to these days is David G. Mm-hmm. He used to be with the Chopra Center,
right.
and I just love his voice. And currently it's a body scan meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of releasing whatever's being held in different parts of your body, bringing consciousness to those parts of your body.
So the whole point
is
the resources are there.
Yes.
All you got to do is Google it or YouTube it. It's just doing it.
Well, yeah, that's true. You know, I mean, how much exercise equipment do most people have in their homes and just don't use it? I get it. It's you know, the Nike thing. Just do it. And I think it's pretty important to have a coach or at least someone on your team that can coach you through some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we appoint ourselves when we have patients come into the office.
Gosh, Mary Grace, there's so much more. I know we can be talking about this, but I don't want to forget this. Please share your contact information about the chiropractic office up in Fishers.
Certainly. We are Stillpoint Family Chiropractic. We are at 9780 Lantern Road, Suite 230 in Fishers. We are on the back side of the building right next to ProScan Imaging. Our website is drpennella.com, so drpennella.com. And our phone number is 317-863-0365.
Wonderful, drpennella.com. That's easy to remember.
I tried.
I would encourage you, if you're listening, especially here in the central Indiana area, to check Dr. Pennella out. MG's amazing, and it's a beautiful facility as well. Great energy there. Thank you for coming on. This is an important topic, and I'm so grateful also to see so many other people writing about it and talking about it, because it can be overwhelming given the times we're in. And thank you for sharing your time with us here, and also for yourself being a celebrant of life.
Thank you.
Everywhere you go.
Thank you.
Now, we're going to segue into an interview I did many years ago. This was my second interview I did with the great Daphne Kingma, who's made a great living writing about relationships and love. This was a book she wrote called Loving Yourself.
From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, this is Journeys Fire with your host, Richard Brendan.
Welcome to Journeys Fire. I'm Richard Brendan. Daphne Rose Kingma makes a return visit here on Journeys Fire to talk about her newest book, Loving Yourself. You know, it's only when we can give ourselves that love that we can truly and ever more deeply share loving relationships with others. It's so essential for a successful journey. And Daphne joins us today from her office in Southern California. Daphne Kingma, welcome to Journeys Fire.
It is my great pleasure to be with you again, Richard.
Well, it was a joy to have you on the first time, and since then you've been traveling a bit and you've been writing a bit, and now we're talking about something I think most important. As a matter of fact, you've said that loving yourself is the greatest work you'll do in this life.
I believe that because, you know, we are each responsible for our own soul, our own being, our own expression of it through life and our personalities, and I think we tend so often to look for that fulfillment of love or that, you know, completion of our expression through another person in, you know, in what we call relationship, and that's a wonderful blessing. As you know, I've written many books on this topic, but this is sort of the core underlying thing that is the issue for all of us.
Well, early on in the book, you talk about the demons that we all have that really need to be, I think the phrase you use, drag them out into the light. And oftentimes, and what a good word, because sometimes we need to drag them out because they don't want to come out.
That's right. And of course, as long as they're in the dark, then they have control. You know, whatever is kept secret is really controlling us, whether that's, you know, something in your unconscious or something you don't share in the light. I don't know. It's like the witch in The Wizard of Oz, you know, when she finally came out and was addressed, you know, she melted away. And I think that's like all of these issues for all of us. And it's just amazing how, you know, we all have this issue. If we didn't have issues about loving ourselves, we'd all be avatars and enlightened beings, and we wouldn't be on this planet having this conversation. So, and yet, it's for each person, whatever those issues are so painfully, exquisitely personal. It's like, oh, you know, if anybody knew how I really felt about myself. And there's this kind of beautiful sigh of relief when we can tell each other, yes, I struggle in this way, and yes, I struggle in that way, and then we sort of find our humanity together through this.
And so the question, really, I think the beginning question is, how do we get this way?
Well, all of these feelings arise in childhood, and, you know, we all sometimes imagine that everybody else doesn't have them because they had the perfect mother and father, but one of the things that I say very clearly in the book is that every person alive has issues that arise from their childhood, because no human pair of parents could ever be perfect. No family structure is ever perfect. And, you know, as I say, we've heard a lot about dysfunctional families, but the truth is every family is dysfunctional in some way.
Yeah.
And so it's not a matter of, you know, pointing a finger at the weird dysfunctional family, but looking at how your particular family experience has affected you, and therein lie the seeds of your own struggle to love yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you talk about, and I'd like for you to address this for our listeners, the whole importance of understanding your life theme.
Yes, that is huge. What the life theme is a particular kind of theme, note that is sounded in your life in childhood and then has this kind of repetitive quality. And there are a number of life themes. It's like, I'll just list them off. Neglect is one, mm-hmm. abandonment, abuse, rejection, emotional suffocation, and deprivation, you know, circumstantial deprivation or emotional deprivation. So, you know, these are pretty big, heavy, hairy words, but they encompass the areas in which, when we are children, we experience imperfection in the love that we received in our growing up environment. And mm-hmm. and however that is expressed, very interestingly, has a way of kind of repeating itself in our lives, because we're sort of almost chemically attracted to what feels familiar. So, for example, if you were abandoned as a child, if your, you know, father took off and you never saw him again, there will be a tendency to be drawn, if you're a woman, to a man who, you know, is a workaholic, or a man who suddenly decides that he's got to go back to his old girlfriend, or a man who's going to take the job overseas and see you in 2 years. So it becomes a theme because it's repeated, and it's often repeated in childhood. You know, your father leaves, your dog dies, your best friend moves away. You know, there may be a number of instances in childhood, but then because we're innerly kind of tuned into that,
yeah.
then it tends to become what is the theme in our life that we then have to rewrite somehow.
It also makes for great country western music, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So true.
But you're right, because we do carry that baggage with us into our current relationships, and we wonder why they don't work out.
Right. And the, you know, the amazing thing about these life themes is that they are so powerful that if we don't examine them, that is all we will live in our lives. The only way to, you know, to open that up and to have a broader experience of yourself where you don't feel abandoned every minute all the time by everybody is to really bring it out into the light and say, yes, this is what happened to me. This is what this dark secret of mine is that I'm carrying around as an expectation of what's going to continue to happen. So the healing for it, the very first step of the healing, of course, is to realize that you, me, everybody on the planet has a life theme.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to figure out what it is. I've spent some time in the book, you know,
mm-hmm.
illustrating that, and I just want to say this, too. It's just amazing. When I do workshops with people on various topics, this or other relationship topics, you know, we'll bring up this matter of the life theme. Nobody has any idea of what their theme is in a very specific way. You know, they may say, well, I don't know, I just wasn't a very happy kid or something
mm-hmm.
like that. So what I'm emphasizing here is that the more you can know exactly what this is for you, the more profound are your chances of leading a more loving, expansive life. Don't be afraid of finding it out. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, because you first need the awareness before you can begin to make the change.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, what does it really mean to love yourself? Let's start with that first, because a lot of people have a lot of different ideas on that. Some would even say it's narcissistic or selfish.
Well, that's true. I think it means coming to a place of balance and acceptance I mean, those are very general words, but it means that, you know, the habits of not loving yourself have faded into the background. It means that you can receive yourself in both your positive attributes and also your limits and failings. And it means that you can be kind and attentive to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so much easier to see, you know, what's going on with somebody else. You know, they should take better care of themselves. They should get a better relationship. They should, you know, have a vacation, and not to say, well, what about me? And so it's a kind of changing of an inner format in which, when you look at all the people who need love, care, and attention, you include yourself among them, and then you start doing the actual work of training. It really is a process of training yourself in the behaviors that can ultimately result in feeling different about yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And what happens if you don't learn to love yourself? What are the traits for a person like that?
Well, the traits are, you know, certainly an unhappy life, tremendous difficulty in relationships, a problem in fulfilling your talents. I believe we all have very special and beautiful gifts that we've arrived here with, and that we have a spiritual responsibility to express those, and that when you don't do that, there's a lot of depression going around this country.
Oh, yeah.
And part of that is that people are not in tune with themselves. They haven't healed from these childhood wounds, don't know what their life was about, don't know what their gifts are, and aren't using them. Well, that is the perfect recipe for depression. So it's, you know, it expresses itself in physical and emotional lack of health, in difficulty in relationships, and in unfulfilled lives.
Daphne, how much do you attribute busyness to a lot of this? Because one of the things I've noticed, you have a lot of wonderful stories throughout the book. One of the common themes that I've seen are when people finally begin to slow down enough to either meditate or become a little more aware.
Yeah.
But it does take that, doesn't it?
That's a really good point. Yes, Richard, because we all are leading these horribly, you know, jam-packed, over-programmed lives. But the first conscious choice after awareness is to say, am I willing to address whatever corner of sanctuary I can create in my life, whether that's just saying, you know, I'm not going to take my cell phone in my car. I'm not going to listen to the radio in my car. I mean, we just allow ourselves to be inundated with things, even beyond the responsibilities that we have, you know, to provide for ourselves and for others and, you know, get in the car and get the food or go to the work or whatever. But, you know, even the tiniest turning of attention toward these things, and I hope that in the book I've laid out, you know, increments of examples that are not, you know, give yourself a $250,000 diamond and a vacation. You know, it's like the Richard Burton solution.
Yeah.
But a solution that you can immediately start enacting in your own life, you know, whether that's, well, we can talk about the specific things, but yes, it is very difficult. We live in a tremendously overprogrammed world. It impinges on us at every corner. But we do have a choice about, you know, there are moments, there are 20-minute increments of a day that you can make a choice about that can dramatically change how you feel about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Love Doctor is in the house. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about Daphne Rose King, a psychotherapist, best-selling author. Our topic of conversation today, loving yourself, 4 steps to a happier you. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Journey's Fire.
Thank you.
Daphne, when I was reading your book, I couldn't help but remember a quote by Gandhi when he said, "Peace between countries rests upon the solid foundation of love between individuals." And then I was reflecting on what you were writing. I said, but you know, that even rests upon loving ourself.
Right.
And this loving yourself has everything to do with everything, successful relationships, but even on what's even going on in the world. It's so important that we get that.
Right. It is so important.
Well, you offer 4 steps that you've come up with in terms of greater peace, compassion towards ourselves. So let's get into those right now. And the first one is speaking out.
Yes. Isn't that amazing and simple and terribly difficult?
It is, because as you said in the book, the emphasis really is on the word out. So explain what that means for you, speaking out.
Right. Well, it means taking something from inside your own consciousness that is meaningful to you and directing it outward. And, you know, so often we're just talking about meaningless things. You know, where's the screwdriver? Mm-hmm. Did you pick up the clothes from the cleaners? I mean, I know those things have their little place in our lives. But we're not talking about the things that deeply affect how we feel about ourselves. And so we're not gaining the responses that we need of respect, of care, of, you know, attention from others.
Yeah.
And because we don't use the energy to put those words out, we continue to feel unworthy, unloved, not valuable, et cetera, all the bad, you know, properties of not feeling loved.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's amazing how huge just the opportunity or the transformation that can happen when we start articulating what is deeply true for us. And you know, there are several ways of speaking out that are very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very difficult often simply to reveal things about yourself. You know, a lot of times, and I think this is true of every one of us, we have things that we've done, that we've experienced, that we're ashamed of, embarrassed about, that we feel have somehow compromised our value.
Yes.
We're very afraid of revealing those. We're, you know, if so-and-so knew this about me, then
they might not love me.
Right.
Right.
And so just self-disclosure at times can be so huge. I met a new friend recently, a week or so ago, and we were having lunch together, and at the end she told me, we're sitting in the car, and she told me about her parents. You know, we were telling each other about our parents and
mm-hmm.
our past, and she disclosed to me that both of her parents were manic depressives. And when she got done, you know, kind of tears filled her eyes, and she just said, you know, I've never been able to tell anyone that before. So that was a moment of speaking out for her, in which, you know, she then went on to say how she always felt that she was going to go crazy and she'd never have a happy life, and, you know, what the internal impact of this truth about her parents had on her.
Mm-hmm.
And that just being able to say that dramatically changed how she felt about herself in that moment. So some of the speaking out is just, you know, saying things, and some of it asking for things, which is terribly difficult for most of us. We have to trust that we're worthy. We have to be vulnerable and show that we're not complete. And we have to be willing to receive what's given when we get what we ask for. And I think this is often very difficult for men because, you know, in our culture, men are supposed to, well, you tell me, but have everything together and not have this vulnerability of need.
Well, yeah, and yet it's so self-empowering because, as you, I believe, said in the book, that speaking out changes the voices in your head, all the self-criticisms.
Right, right, because suddenly you see that you can be loved, you stand strong in the face of the revelation you've made. People honor you for the courage that you've expressed about yourself, and whether that is in the terms of asking or revealing. Then, of course, another part of speaking out is expressing anger, which is a very challenging thing for many people. You know, I think we're a culture that pretty much stuffs our anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we drink it away and smoke it away and potato chip it away. And
well, now you're meddling.
We're chipping away at our anger.
We are chipping away. I like that. Well, you know, what I talked about earlier as far as the out part being significant really holds true with the second step, and it's what you encourage people to do in terms of acting out. It's more than just taking action.
Right. It's doing it in the context that you must live your life in, with the people, in the environment. So obviously action is doing more than speaking. It's it's doing behaviors that are uncharacteristic for you and that mean you are going to experience yourself as a different person. And again, you know, like speaking out and acting out, all these things are often things that we have kind of parental dictums about, you know, don't show off, don't speak up, don't wear the purple skirt to the prom, don't, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So that taking action, the action that is self-expressive, is often very scary for us. And again, whenever you do that, you're affirming your own value. There are many ways of doing that. Sometimes it's, you know, doing a daring thing that you were afraid to do. Sometimes it's taking an action in behalf of your health. Sometimes it's just deciding to do something about somebody else. I'm telling a story on my daughter when she was little. I used to ask her so many times, as every mother on the planet does, to clean up her room with something. I think it was that.
Uh-huh.
And finally, just one day, I very quietly went to her room and put all her things away where she couldn't find them. And then she finally understood what the meaning of my message was. It was like I could have talked for another 25 years, but it was like, oh, you know, where is my big lion? It's vanished. So when you take an action, you communicate how important certain things are,
yeah,
not only to other people, but, of course, most importantly, to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to bust out, because oftentimes it seems we're encouraged often to live small rather,
yes,
than live big.
Exactly.
In your book, you even wrote that when you turn 30, you try to do something new every year.
That's true.
So that's only been, what, 3 years ago?
I'm just finding my way.
Just finding your way. But that is so good, because it gives us a feeling of hope that we don't have to be trapped by our current circumstances. We're stepping out of the comfort zone.
Exactly. And, of course, each time you do that, there is an incredible sense of exhilaration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I believe that that happens literally on a physical level, that different chemicals are released in your body because you have overstepped your own bounds in a way that makes you feel emotionally proud, but also makes you feel physically tremendously alive.
Yeah.
So that's a great thing.
Yeah, that is great. The phrase you use, which I really like, is conscious action.
Yes. In other words, it's just not flailing around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not acting out psychologically in a punitive way. You know, it means really thinking through, what would I like to expand in myself? You know, would I like to get that PhD? Would I like to lose 20 pounds? Would I like to learn how to use some kind of, I don't know, a computer or something,
mm-hmm,
that I've never used before, to draw blueprints on a computer instead of by hand? Whatever that personal frontier is for you, to really say, okay, I'm going to really take the steps in reality that will change my reality about that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so we don't have any regrets. Life goes by so fast.
Yes, it does.
The fourth step you talk about is a clearing out.
Talk
about that process.
Well, clearing out means removing from your life and psyche things that, when they remain there, just make you feel bad about yourself. And sometimes those are, you know, all the old things in your closet, because you haven't taken the time to get rid of them. They carry all sorts of energies that define you in a certain way and clutter up your space. And sometimes it's, you know, concluding relationships. I mean, there are people who pass through seasons in our life, and then they're not really germane to the journey that we're taking now, and it's not appropriate that they're there anymore. So having the courage to complete relationships that are not right about your own evolution at the moment. And also, I think clearing energetic space where you know, there are certain people's vibes and certain places that are very negative energy, and either getting out of there or transforming the energy in some way. I told a story in the book, you know, about a place that I went to that had very bad vibes, and I mm-hmm. realized that some, you know, very painful, awful things had happened there. Well, we're very sensitive to these energies, and we don't always know it, but it's important to be in tune with that and to say, okay, if I don't feel good with this person, I'm not going to continue to be there.
Yeah.
And give ourselves permission to get rid of the things, to end the relationships, to clear our own consciousness of all the negative self-talk and berating that we can do inside our own minds, to just say, I'm not going to listen to this anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk to myself and listen to this anymore.
Yeah. The speaking out, acting out, and clearing out are what you would consider three steps on the psychological level. Now the spiritual plane, that's the fourth one, and that's setting out. It's kind of an awareness of a higher self.
Yes, and of course I always love that part. And
yeah.
Because it really is the level in which everything else is woven together into, you know, a meaningful whole. And the setting out is really setting out on a path of transformation, of self-transformation and service. And that is that, you know, once we have awareness about our inner life, our history, our life theme, and once we take these other steps, ultimately we have to ask the question, why am I here and what is the meaning of my existence?
Mm.
And so I'm encouraging people to set out on a path that really is the search and discovery for your own life's purpose and meaning, and to put that in action and to, you know, develop some sort of path or practice that allows you to connect with the reality that your life is purposeful and meaningful, that it isn't just a joke that you're here, that you do have something to contribute, that you are part of the whole. And that only when you are walking that path will your life have cohesion and wholeness and true joy. Because on a psychological level, we can get happy, you know. Somebody can send you a dozen roses and you're happy, and that's a wonderful experience. But in the expanded self mm-hmm. that we are, to live in a state of joy is to really know each moment and all the experiences are part of the wholeness of why you came here, and that you have found the vehicle to give your gift.
Daphne, we are just about out of time. It always goes so fast with
it's
you,
just
but
amazing.
It is. Give our listeners your website address.
My website is daphnekingma.com, and all of the books, this new one and all the others that precede it, are listed there. And, of course, the book is available on Amazon.com.
And once again, another great book. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that's today's program. I want to thank my special guest, Mary Grace Pinella, being on the show. DrPinella.com is a website address. Our website is richardbrendan.org, a reminder that all shows are podcast on the site. And so for the amazing engineer, Aaron Duvall, and the talented production coordinator, Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. Hey, we're all just trying to bring love to life, one broadcast at a time.